Hello and welcome to our new charity digital podcast, How Did You Get There? I'm Sasha Dabalia, and in this podcast series, I'll be speaking with esteemed charity sector peers, tech pioneers, activists, philanthropists, inspiring volunteers, and community leaders on the path they took to get to where they are now and achieve some of their biggest successes. Today, I'm really excited to introduce our first ever guest to this podcast series, Danny Attias. Danny Attias entered the charity sector in 2016 as the CIO of Anthony Nolan, the world's first stem cell register and a UK charity that saves the lives of people with blood cancer and blood disorders. His job title changed to Chief Digital and Information Officer in 2020, where Danny was ranked number one in the CIO 100 in this role. Danny has now moved to London Business School as its first full CDIO. So, it's a pleasure to welcome you, Danny. Thanks so much for being our first guest on this podcast series. So there's a lot that I want to ask you about how you got to this place, but we're going to first start off with a few quick fire round questions just to get to know you a little bit more. So are you ready?
I'm ready. And thank you, Sasha, for having me on as your first guest. This is very exciting and such a delight to be on the other side of the podcast where I'm not having to host.
That's right.
Pressure is off.
You're normally sitting in my seat as the host of Sondership, but we'll definitely talk about that a little bit more later on. First off, Zoom or Teams?
Teams. Ooh, I'm not going to hesitate.
I love Teams. That was so decisive.
Because I'm now in an institution that uses Zoom very heavily, which is brilliant. Zoom is brilliant. Zoom is incredible. But Zoom is standalone and it does not integrate with your chat and with your documents and with your community. And Teams, 100%.
Brilliant. Coffee or tea? You wake up in the morning. What do you go for?
So in the morning, I switch. It depends on the mood. So I will go through a coffee phase, then I'll go through a tea phase, then I'll go through a green tea phase. But normally only when I'm reading Haruki Murakami novels, I'll switch to green tea throughout that period. So it does differ. I think during lockdown, it was definitely Nespresso coffee all the way through.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I think we were all a bit like that, weren't we? So are you a cat or a dog person?
Cat, 100% cat. So love dogs. We do foster puppies for Hearing Dogs for Deaf People to help them get socialized and before they train up fully to become service dogs for deaf people. But we have two beautiful Maine Coon, enormous giant cats, and they're absolutely so exquisite. And they're kind of slightly dog-like in their behavior, but ultimately, when it boils down to it, it's got to be cats.
That's amazing. I love that. And last question, if you had a superpower, what would it be?
Oh, I don't have an answer for that. Superpower, flying has just got to be it. If you just take everything else out of the equation, you know, Superman could do a lot of things, but he could fly. And that was just the best thing in the world. Yeah. And sometimes I feel like I'm flying when I'm swimming. So there's just moments when you're swimming and you're turning and you're weightless and you're flying. And that's the kind of closest I get to flying, as opposed to jumping out of planes, which is more like falling.
You swim quite often, I assume, then.
I try and swim 3-4 times a week.
Yeah, that's lovely. Brilliant. All right. Well, I'm going to go back a bit. I want to sort of start at the beginning of, I suppose we could say journey, okay. If that doesn't sound too cliche. Let's start off with your time at university. So you did chemical engineering, if that's right, at University of Loughborough. So I'm just wondering, you know, how come you chose that subject and how was your time there as well?
Yeah, so I chose the subject when I was 12 or 13, which it seems a bit early, doesn't it? But when I was asked the question of, you're going to need to decide what GCSEs you're going to do, I thought, well, okay, what is the impact of this decision? Asked 12-year-old Danny to himself. Well, the impact is it will determine what A-levels you can do, clearly. You know. So, okay, well, what's the impact of that decision? Well, that'll impact what degree you can do. And what's the impact of that decision? Well, that'll impact your career. And so I decided at that point I wanted to do chemical engineering. For whatever reason, I want to be an engineer and I really like chemistry. Little did I know there's no chemistry in chemical engineering, but that's a different story. So I did my GCSE choices. I did maths, chemistry, and physics. And then I went, as predicted, to Loughborough. I did chemical engineering, which is one of the best engineering institutions in the country. And also big in sport. I don't do sport. I don't like sport. I've never watched any sporting event of any type ever. But so I did my degree, and I did a year in industry, and this was really important. So I went to lots of red brick universities and I said, can I do a placement year? And like, yeah, you could take a year out and go and find a placement. Whereas Loughborough were all about learning on the job. They were all about industrial placements. So they helped me get a placement year at Kodak, where I worked mixing the kind of the liquids that would pour onto photographic paper to make photographic paper. But what I realized throughout that process is I didn't really get engineering. I didn't naturally, intuitively understand it. And all this time, I had decided I did not want to study technology. I did not want to work in technology because I loved technology so much that I didn't want to ruin the experience. And that was based on, I did a little bit of skiing, not a huge amount, but I remember seeing ski instructors and I'm thinking, you must have the best job in the world. You get to ski all day. And I would have this conversation, again, 12-year-old Danny here, having a conversation with ski instructors. And they're like, yeah, I don't really get to ski. I just get to, you know, teach dweebs like you go up and down slopes. Really, you know, how often do you actually hit the slopes and the powder? And the fact is, they maybe once a week they had a window, but they were too exhausted. So maybe once a month they would get. And I just thought, I don't want to do that. I don't want to ruin my hobby by turning it into work. Everything changed further down the line, obviously. And even at school, I remember I would have been about 16, and the school were about to invest in a brand new computer network. So 486 PCs, that's kind of going back to a different century or millennium. But I ended up being involved in the tender process of that network. I don't know how, but I ended up being involved. In fact, I ended up redefining the tender process and redefining the supplier of choice and unpicking, kind of really managing the vendor, and then helping run the computer network at the school during lunchtimes for kids. This was at 16. Wow. So I even actually had an office with my name on it, and it said computer network manager when I was at school. It was awesome. So I really love tech, and I never really coded or anything. I just liked the possibility of tech, the things that it could do. So it's a really long answer to your question. Apologies for that.
I'm loving it.
But the general gist is, after I did my year in industry and went back for my final year, I realized I'm not an engineer, even though I just presumed I would be an engineer. I'm just not. I didn't really understand distillation towers and pumps and centrifuges. Yeah. And so I thought, well, I just want to get a job in something that I enjoy, that I could make decent money, and I could work in London. And finance and tech were the kind of the two most obvious.
Yeah.
And I just kind of looked around, and I landed on my feet with a graduate placement at the John Lewis Partnership.
Yeah,
which is another story. But yeah,
I mean, we can go into that if you want. Yeah, that's really interesting. I like what you said about not wanting to make a hobby work, because I think quite a lot of people do say, well, we'll do something that you really love, you know, so that you're never working a day of your life.
Yeah.
That's always something that I hear.
And that's absolutely true. So that's why I said it all turned around, because then I realized, and I even said this in my interview for John Lewis, is I'm going to spend the vast majority of my waking hours on this planet working for you. I want to enjoy what I'm doing. I want to understand what I'm doing. And it's really, it boils down to four things. It's do something you love, do something you're good at, do something you can make a living out of, and then if you can, do something the world needs. And if you can get that fourth one, then you've got ikigai, which is a kind of Japanese concept. But if getting those three at least are just so important. So I realized, actually, doing something you really enjoy, that you really understand, but also you are good at. I had one, my first manager, actually, she said to me about a year and a half in, do you want to manage people? And I said, well, I don't know. How's about you give me a small team to run? And then I'll tell you whether I like it, and you tell me whether I'm any good at it. And if we both agree, then we'll keep doing it. And if one of those isn't true, then I probably shouldn't be doing it. And that was probably 22-year-old Annie or 23-year-old Annie. But it was a really good opportunity. Yeah, you want to be enjoying what you do. And I absolutely love what I do. You hear it in my voice, but it's like this all the time. And I think that's really crucially important. Otherwise, you're going into work, you're doing your job for what? For the evening, you're too tired. For the weekend, you're exhausted. You know, for that holiday, for retirement, I'm not going to do all this for retirement or all this for the 2-week holiday or the 1-week holiday. It's just, no, if you can make this the fun bit, then you're winning every single day.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think it's so sad, really, when you think about how many people just don't like their jobs, really. And it's something that we do. It takes up the majority of our day, 5 days a week, you know. So, you're 100% right. And I like what you said about how if you can do something that can help other people. Was that something that was the thought process you had when you decided you wanted to go into the charity sector?
Yes. Yeah, it was a very conscious decision. I'd done a decade in retail and almost a decade. Overaging myself now, almost a decade in kind of another industry, part of WPP, which is about employee recognition and incentives and sales. I mean, it was a lovely company. It was privately founded. It's called the Grassroots Group, and it was a really great organization. But I thought, okay, I'd outgrown it, and it was time to move on. And I decided, right, I've got to do something different. I go on the UN website. What can I do for the UN or local government? I quickly ran away from local government and national government. But I kind of looked around that not-for-profit sector. But I wanted to be doing something that not just gave back to society, but actually made a difference in people's lives. And so when I stumbled across the Andy Nolan role, I kind of looked and I thought, I only knew them because I had been on the register for 20 years. Had I not been on the register, I probably wouldn't have known who they were. I mean, they had no you know, tech footprint as such. Mm. You know, they weren't exactly like the most well-renowned tech leaders. But I just thought this is a good opportunity, and it's a place I can grow.
Yeah, definitely, because that was the first role, wasn't it? Their CIO, they'd never had one before. Is that right?
Yeah, they quite understandably. Had chosen not to put money into technology because they wanted to put money into patients. Mm, yeah. Obviously not realizing that putting money into technology was putting money into patients, but they're there now, so that's okay. But it had 10 years of underinvestment, 10 years of, I mean, it was pretty bad. It was a pretty bad state. But I just to go back a second, actually, when I took that role, I was a group CIO, 25 companies in a group across 16 countries, pretty awesome. But actually, I was an IT director. I was a glorified infrastructure manager in real terms. And there was a recruitment consultant I spoke to who's brilliant. So when I say what I'm about to say, it sounds really negative, but it wasn't negative at all. And he said to me, "You're not a CIO." And he didn't mean that in a negative way, but he's saying, "You are an IT director, you're an infrastructure manager. You're not doing the things that a CIO needs to be doing. So your next move is going to be really hard. Making that step to get a CIO role is going to be really hard. But once you've got it, you're there." And I remember going to the interview at Andy Nolan, and I'll come back to a short story about resilience. But I went for the interview at Andy Nolan, and I remember saying, "I've never done software development before. I've never managed software development before. I don't really know what data is. I know what information is, but I don't really know what we mean. But when we talk about data, I definitely don't know what we mean when you talk about digital. You know, we need to be more digital. I don't know what that is. I'd never heard of GDPR, so I didn't even use that word because I'd heard of the Data Protection Act 1998, but I didn't know what it was. And they gave me the job. So that was a kind of really interesting, what I said was, but I'm a quick study and I can figure this stuff out and I can learn this stuff and I will get it done for you. And I just think, in contrast to the other people that they interviewed who were all from the charity sector, they just thought, this person's got energy, they've got enthusiasm, we think this person can deliver for us. Clearly, I didn't do that on my own, and I'll tell you that story in a moment. But if I just go back about resilience, when I applied for the Andy Nolan job, my CV actually ended up going straight into the trash can. No one ever saw my CV at all. I applied the day before the closing date, and the recruitment partner that was running that recruitment for them, well, that guy had already done the shortlist, had already set up the first interviews and gone on holiday to Australia. So my CV went nowhere. And it was only because I reached out to the interim IT director on LinkedIn, who used to work at a company that I'd gone in and given a talk to about going to Google Apps, which is something that I did really early, that I wrote to him and just made that connection and said, oh, you might not remember me. I came in and spoke to your team. Just to let you know, I've applied for this role. If you want to chat, let me know. And within about 2 hours, we're on the call. And then he was inviting me in for the interview. And then I got the second interview, and we kind of turned it around really quickly. But had I, that's a kind of thing about resilience and about connections, but I had not, my CV would have gone nowhere.
Gosh, yeah. That's so
I was really glad I reached out.
Yeah, definitely. Kind of making sure that you keep that persistence, really. If you want something, you've got to check in with it a bit more than that once. Yeah, that's so...
Yeah, don't just wait for things to come to you. Just go out, put yourself out there, challenge it, go out and get it. And if it doesn't work, then try again.
Yeah, amazing. So you got into that role. And then you were kind of nominated number one of CIO 100. How did that feel, kind of seeing that? And, you know, how did you do it, essentially?
Okay, so I'm going to start with how I did it, because I didn't do it, okay? And I'm not being cliche and say it was all about the team, but it was all about the team. So I walk into a job that requires me to run a software development function and a data function and all of these things I have not got a clue how to do. And fortuitously, I met up with an old friend, old because I've known her for a long time, not because she's old, an old friend we used to meet for dinner once a year, pretty much, from John Lewis. And I said to her, I've got a new job. I'm going to Andy Nolan. It just so happened that she was also on the Sensor Register for 20 years, so she knew Andy Nolan. It was really quite close to her heart. B, she was in the place where she was doing a kind of temp role which didn't really fulfill her, and she wanted to give back and she wanted to do something with purpose. Mm. And C, she just happened to be the person who pretty much built the software development team for the whole of Ocado from day one. So she said, I'm coming with you.
And I said,
yeah.
Wow,
yeah,
okay.
As in, you're not going alone. I am joining your team. And I'm sitting there going, oh, thank God. Someone who actually knows what they're doing. Her name's Laura Phillips, and she's very well established in the charity digital space now. And together we came in and we built pretty much everything, the culture, the methodologies, everything from scratch. I learned a huge amount from her, a huge amount. And that's how we did it. So that's how I learned. I couldn't have kind of figured out software development on my own. That would have been a little bit too tricky. And so we created the team together. So in 2018, I'm going to say we were listed in the CIO 100, although it had my name on the front, but I was listed. I had had this dream, is probably pushing it a little bit far, but maybe aspiration to be in the CIO 100. Yeah. So much so, talk about planning ahead, when I got the job at Andy Nolan, it was an IT director, and I said to the CEO, can we make it CIO? She's like, yeah, sure. Because I wanted to be in the CIO 100 and I wanted my title to be CIO. Yeah. Not that I ever expected to get in there, but I aspired to be in there. And so 2 years later, I applied. And I asked one of the former judges, you know, is it worth applying? And he said, well, but he said, well, either way, apply, because even if you don't get in, then you've got history. Yeah. They can see where you were and where you've gone to, and that will be useful. So I just put in a very speculative application, and I got the call to say I was listed in the top 100, but keep it under your bonnet for a few weeks, but come to the event. Yeah. And then you turn out of the event and there's this little booklet and you look through the booklet to try and find yourself. So everyone in the room knows where they are now, but you've just walked in. You don't know where you are. So I go to the back, obviously, you know, 100, 99, 90, I'm not there. And I keep going and I got to 80 or 70 and I can't believe I missed myself. Let's go back to the beginning. And I went to 100 and someone tapped me on the shoulder and she said, you might want to look a little bit further down. And I was listed at number 9. So this was the highest place, not for profit, the highest place charity, sorry, wow. Highest place charity, highest place new entrant as well, which was such enormous confirmation of the work that Laura and I and the rest of the team over time that we had grown had been able to achieve. It was, and I thought, that's it. Okay, I've done my CIO 100 thing now. Mm. So much so I didn't even apply the following year. I was like, I can't beat 9. I can't beat top 10. That's yeah. it. And then I applied for the 2020 CIO 100. I thought, well, it's time. I should again put it in. I'm not going to beat number 9, but okay, great. And it got delayed because of the pandemic. It got delayed about 5 months. So little did I know, a number of people that I was engaging with on a regular basis who were judges knew what the result was, but no one told me. No one let on anything at all. And then I got the email saying, you're in the top 100. Congratulations. I'm like, yay. And then about 2 hours later, I got an email saying, oh, you've done quite well. So we might like you to be involved in a couple of talks and so on. Are you available? I'm like, yeah, I'm available. Can we talk now? And the editor, the then editor, they've had a few changes, but the then editor just, he got on a call and he said to me, opened with, this is the call I've most been looking forward to make for a number of months. And I thought, that's such a weird thing to say, because I had no idea what he was going to, you know, I didn't know what was coming next. So I just thought, that's a bit odd. And then he said, you've got the top spot. But he didn't say you're number one. He said, you got the top spot. So for almost days later, I was trying to reprocess the words going, did he say you've got a top spot? It didn't make sense to me, because here we are in a mid-sized charity. We've done some good work, don't get me wrong, but there's a lot of brilliant people there doing a lot of brilliant work. So it kind of didn't really add up. But it was just that what it boiled down to is what we were able to achieve with a small team and a small budget on a global scale. And the team size is around 25 of the whole of technology and data and information security. And I look at what that team have achieved and are achieving today, to the point that third parties like Microsoft are saying to us, that's the quickest migration to Azure we've ever seen. Our security consultants are saying to us, that's the single biggest uplift to the Microsoft security score that we've ever seen. We're taking concepts like algorithms to match patients and donors for stem cell transplantation. And we're going, why are we reinventing the wheel? We're going to build this once and once and for all. We're going to make it an open source product. We're going to put it onto GitHub. And we are going to make it available to any registry in the world. We're also going to automate the build. We're going to automate. Yeah, it's a bit more work, but it's not that much more work. If you really put your heart into it, you focus on it and say, no one ever has to do this again. We can all collaborate on the same platform and we can make it better and better and better. So I think the judges looked at the scale, the impact, the speed, kind of the tenacity, and the fact that, you know, they are saving the lives of people with blood cancer every single day, and just said, this is it. This outguns many larger organizations with significantly more resource.
Yeah, amazing, really. I'm wondering, because it seems as though you've done so much during your time at Anthony Nolan. Have you got an idea of what you would say was one of your biggest achievements within the team that you managed to kind of do during that time?
Yeah, without hesitation, actually. So, and it's Laura and I. So it's, you know, it's everything that we did was Laura and I. But we found people within the organization who had no technology experience whatsoever. So I'll give you the specific example here. In 2015, I wasn't at Anthony Nolan, but I was on the stem cell register, and I got contacted by Anthony Nolan saying, hey, Danny, you might be a match for someone who needs a life-saving transplant. Like, amazing, suddenly off my bloods. I wasn't a perfect match in the end because they have to go through a few different people. And the lady that engaged with me was working as in an administrative function. And I remember her name because her name was quite peculiar. It was, I can't pronounce it. So her short version of her name is Margot. I think it's Margot. I can't do it. So Margot Urban. And I just remembered her name. And then when I started, she's like, your name looks familiar. And I'm like, your name looks familiar. And it was, we had realized we'd had this contact. The point of this story is not that. The point of this story is Margot today is the director of product for Anthony Nolan. That's the key. So yeah. Margot has gone from having all of the potential, the intelligence, the capability, the understanding of every single process, the value of patients and donors and how the organization works at a low level, working across all of these administrative functions, moving into project office support, moving into business analysis, moving into project management, ultimately becoming the person who is right now, this minute, yeah, working on developing digital proof of concepts for reducing the time for transplants by interacting with hospitals in the UK. Yeah. You know, right now is leading that project. So, and Margot's just one of a few examples, but that, you know, without a doubt, because what you're doing there is you're giving people this growth opportunity. You're giving the organization the best staff they could possibly dream of, because it's people who are their own, who understand it. You're role modeling to everyone else what you can become and what you can achieve. And you're creating a sustainable team that can continue to fulfill and grow. So that, without a doubt, is the single biggest achievement that Laura and I and Margot, you know, now Margot's doing it. So Margot's got four more people under her wing from within the business who are training up as business analysts or developing as product owners, who are learning about Scrum and design thinking. Moments before, they were working in laboratories or working on fundraising, you know, completely different roles.
Yeah.
So yeah, without a doubt, that would be the biggest highlight.
That sounds really wonderful, to be able to see the growth of someone going from that point to now where they are. It must be wonderful to be able to see that within your team, really.
To be honest, actually, she's now advising me. So I'm not kidding. I'm going to her with problems, and she's like picking through it all and going, well, obviously, da da da. And I'm going, a week later, I'm going, oh yeah, you're right. So she's schooling me, and it's brilliant.
Yeah, no, that's so wonderful. I also was thinking, just in terms of your team, so am I right in thinking that 50% of the developers within the team were female as well? Which,
yeah,
unfortunately, that's something that is a rarity when you think about the tech world. Unfortunately, it's just not something that's as common as we'd like it to be. And I know I read somewhere that you said it wasn't about ticking a box. I wonder what it meant for you, essentially.
It's about, there are many different angles to this. Firstly, it doesn't happen by accident. You don't just see where the chips fall and go count up gender or count up ethnicity or whatever diversity metric you want and see what you've got. You have to work really hard to get those outcomes. So what does it mean? It means two different things. One of the things is about creating opportunity, creating a pipeline, role modeling for young girls, you know, the possibility of working in STEM. 70% of jobs in the future will require some STEM skills. So just do not miss that stuff. Art is hugely important as well, but you've got to get those basics. So part of it is about opportunity, especially social mobility. The other part of it, and if you read Matthew Syed's Rebel Ideas and many other literature on this topic, cognitive diversity is essential for good outcomes in any business. So if you've got, and I'm poorly quoting Matthew Syed now, but if you've got 10 people and each one has 10 ideas, how many ideas have you got? Well, if they're all the same, if they all went to Oxbridge and they all had very privileged backgrounds and they all studied in the same way, then you've probably got about 10 ideas. But if they are truly diverse, looking at things from completely different angles with different perspectives, then you might have 100 ideas. And that's the difference, is do you want 10 ideas or do you want 100 ideas? Yeah. Because if you want that different set of perspective, then and one of the first things that I've done since joining London Business School is try to empower the team to say, there is no command and control here. We're not going to set the rules and tell you what to do. We're all really experienced professionals here. So you have a voice. You need to call stuff out. You need to be kind. You need to be respectful. We want to invest in you. We want to grow. And already in a very short period of time, I've got some of the people now really challenging me. And I'm giving them an answer and they're going, yeah, but I don't accept that. And I had an incident last week where a guy was challenging me and challenging me. And I was like, you're right. And within 2 hours, we fixed a massive problem that had been going on for years. No one was taking stuff seriously. We're going, we just looked at it from a different perspective and said, let's just try it out. And if it fails, it fails. That's fine. But at least have a go. Don't be scared of testing it and failing. Yeah. So that cognitive diversity, you know, from a business perspective, but then that opportunity from a diversity and from a human perspective are the two key things.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I find it so shocking that people don't see that, don't see the opportunity in having people from different backgrounds all working together with their different experiences, offering their thoughts, opinions, insights. It's a shame, but it's something that we're seeing, hopefully, is becoming an attitude that is more widespread.
Yeah. One of the first things, just to jump in there, one of the first things I did, I was very lucky that I was able to largely build my direct reports team, so my leadership team at London Business School. So I've got 6 direct reports, all directors, and there were a few slots there. And I went in and just going, we will have gender diversity at the bare minimum. If nothing else, we will start from a point of gender diversity. And we got there. So, you know, by the time I'd hit my first week, I was able to then confirm to the organization that we have 3 men and 3 women in these roles. Mm. So that it's not enough. It doesn't go far enough. We need much more ethnic diversity, and I need to create a much stronger pipeline of ethnically diverse individuals across the team to work their way up and be, you know, that next generation. But I could not start with a team with, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6
yeah.
men only, white, male. It's just not an option. And how can I role model and lead from the front if I'm allowing that to happen? So that was a really important criteria.
Definitely.
But one that I had to actively influence. As what I said is, it doesn't just happen. I had to very consciously go, no, hold on, stop. There's one more role. We need to be very open in this. We need to look at the market properly. We need to challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. No, wonderful. Danny, we're coming to the end of our conversation. But before we get to that point, obviously you're now at London Business School. You've got your podcast, Sondership. I mean, among all the other things that you're doing, why a podcast? What drew you to that?
It's a good question. I don't think I'd ever listened to a podcast up until about 4 months ago, in all honesty. I've got a very short attention span, as you might have been able to tell. And I did a fabulous personal development course called the Alt MBA, which is being created by Seth Godin. Absolutely brilliant. I would recommend everyone to at least look it up. It is well worth the investment of time. It's very intense. It's only about 4.5 weeks. It's very intense. In fact, someone from the charity sector read my blog on this topic on LinkedIn, and he immediately signed up, but he spoke to me first so he could get a discount. So speak to me if you're thinking of doing it, contact me on LinkedIn and I'll get you a discount. But it's a huge amount of time, huge amount. I went in, as you can imagine, full on. So I was spending probably about 20, 25 hours a week on it, on top of my day job. Wow. And the guy said to me, when I went into this, I thought, how am I going to find the time to do this? He said, now I'm halfway through, I'm thinking, what am I going to do with all this time afterwards? Because it makes you realize how incredibly productive you can be. Yeah. And one of the ideas that popped into my head, and it's always dangerous for an idea to pop into my head because generally it happens, is, oh, I'm going to do a podcast. I didn't know what about. I didn't know why or what for. I just decided I want to do a podcast. I think it's because in all the examples, it used it as an example. Say you want to start a podcast. How would you make a decision on X, Y, Z? And it kind of brainwashed me, I think. And so I set myself the task of creating a podcast. And within 2 hours, I defined what it could look like, who the audience could be, what it might be called. And then send that out for feedback, because it's all about learning from each other and getting feedback and getting those different perspectives. But effectively, I decided to call it Sondership. It's based on the concept of Sonder. And Sonder is that moment where you realize that yours is not the only story. You realize that every random passerby has got a life as rich and as complex as your own. And we all have those Sonder moments. And using that as a trigger to tap into someone's life story, into their empathy, into how they turn that Sonder moment into purpose, how they're turning their privilege into allyship, how they're overcoming their imposter phenomenon moments. And I didn't quite know it was going to be exactly that, but the intention is about inspiring stories from people with purpose. So find up someone with purpose, I ask them their Sonder moment, and boom, there goes the conversation. We just dropped episode 16 recently, and it's just getting better and better. And it's getting some great momentum. But the key was that I said, right, I'm going to do it, but I'm not going to waste a lot of time on this. I'm going to do it fast. So from the moment I started to the moment I released episode 1 was 8 weeks. But in those 8 weeks, there was, what is it? What's it called? How am I going to brand it? What's the cover art look like? What's the description look like? Who are the guests? What's the technology that I'm going to use? How do you record it? Releasing a teaser trailer, the first episode. And then actually I had episode 2, 3, and 4 already pre-recorded and edited on day one, so that I was never rushing to get another episode out to take the pressure off. So 8 weeks, pretty intensive, but it's gone really well. We've had a few thousand listeners now tune in, and people are writing to me on a daily basis saying, I want to be part of this journey. I'd like to be on the episode. The one last thing I'll mention, and not wanting to use up all your time, this bit's important about when you kind of do stuff, is about what you do yourself and what you outsource.
Yeah.
And that's really important. So I'm writing on a piece of paper here, but I didn't chop down the tree and make the paper myself, right? I just bought the piece of paper. Well, think about, what do you need to do? Where are you adding true value, and what could someone else do? Mm-hmm. And so one of my decisions was, I will run 8 episodes myself, because I wanted to experience that startup end to end, creating something from nothing. And then I'm going to find someone to go on the journey with me who can pick up as much as they possibly can. So now my fabulous producer, Rachel Barber, picks up the conversation, and then she edits it, creates a transcript, creates the copy and everything else. So I find the guest, I do the interview, and then from that point on, she not just follows the model that I've created, but then tries to add her own creative flair and modify it and change it and challenge it along the way. So that's been a wonderful journey, and one that I hope to continue to release episodes weekly for the foreseeable future.
Amazing. Well, I feel like that leaves us on quite a nice note in terms of the idea of Sonder. The person walking past you on the street who might want to one day be in the same position as you, what sort of words of wisdom would you give them?
Believe in yourself. Don't give up. So find the thing that you enjoy. Find the thing that you're good at. Yeah, these are the two key components. You want to be able to get paid for it and do good in the world. These are brilliant things as well. If you can find something you really take joy out of and that you're good at it, then never stop learning and developing. Keep investing, keep reading, keep open yourself up to feedback so that you can be challenged. Don't take personal offense if someone criticizes the way you do it. Just kind of go, well, what do they see that I can't see? But be kind to other people along that journey, and give to other people and share with other people. And if, as long as you believe in yourself, you continue to learn and develop, you can succeed, you know, without a doubt. And it's a key message I send to my entire team. I've got a whole team of people here who haven't been able to be creative and really kind of believe in themselves. Yeah. So here's your opportunity to do whatever it is you want, but make sure you enjoy it, make sure you're good at it, and keep learning, keep developing.
Fantastic. Wonderful, humbling words of wisdom. Thank you so much, Danny. It's really been a joy to listen to your journey from 12-year-old you to where you are now. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk about your journey. And I'm sure lots of people will come away from listening to this feeling inspired, if nothing else. So thanks for listening. And also thank you so much, Danny, for being our first guest of this new podcast series. Make sure to keep an eye out for the rest of the episodes that will be coming out soon and subscribe. Cheers. Thanks so much.